All the shiurim, I think we've probably announced at the beginning this week, were dedicated by Mel David in the blessed memory of his father, Avram David Zatzal, Avram Meir ben Mordechai. Okay. We'll talk about lots of things that have to do with Pesach, just because there was a question that was posed right before I got up here at the podium. We'll address that question. It's a very pertinent question, and it's a good starting point for a lot of what we'll talk about. And that's as follows. Question was asked about children that have, you know, particular dietary requirements and baby cereals, because pretty much all baby cereals, some of them are actually chametz, but the ones that aren't chametz are certainly kitnios. And the question was, you know, the rice cereal, cornmeal based cereals, etc., those are all kitnios. There's, you know, other types also that they make, fancier types. And the question was, you know, so to mix that with mother's milk, etc., something like that, if there, you know, are there any cereals that are not kitnios, was the way the question was phrased. So it's a perfect starting point. It's important to get that people have, you know, facts straight when they ask a question, when they get an answer. Question is a legitimate question. Most people, most of the halacha that they know is, you know, what they grew up with, what they're used to. And if you're Ashkenazi, so you're used to the kitnios you don't consume on Pesach. And more or less, you assume that that's like, you know, everything else you don't consume on Pesach. And whatever you don't consume, you wouldn't give to your children. And you wouldn't give even to your babies. People want the best for their babies, right? Presumably, when I was asked now about mixing with mother's milk, it's because they're concerned to have the best for their babies, and they want to mix it with what's considered the best. So the same way people want physically what's best, they want spiritually what's best, and what they wouldn't consume themselves, they're not going to give to their children, even to their infants. So very often when people ask a question, there's an assumption in their question. Sometimes the answer to the question isn't something new or different, it's just reevaluating that assumption. Over here, that's a perfect example. And the assumption is that there's a problem of giving kitnios to a baby. There's absolutely, lechatchilo, no problem giving kitnios to a baby. There's no problem giving kitnios to a katan, mibchinat, from the vantage point of the Isser Derabbanan, of the rabbinic prohibition or a minhag that's involved in it. Meaning, when we have an Isser Derabbanan, even Bishul Akum, right? Year round, we don't eat things that a non-Jew, things that need to be cooked, right? Certain types of food items don't need to be cooked. They can be eaten raw. And certain types of food items that are cooked are considered very insignificant type of things. Either it's a tafel, it's something which you only eat when you mix it together with other things, or it's items that maybe you do eat without it being mixed together with other things, but you wouldn't serve it in any, you know, it's like a low class, and I don't want to say low class, maybe even upper class people would eat it, but it's not a classy food item. You wouldn't be mechabed, you wouldn't, you know, serve it to somebody in order to, you know, to show your hospitality to them. You know, they come, you don't offer people gummy bears, right, unless they're little kids, but you put out something, you know, a little bit more substantial, something a little bit more significant for them. So those types of food it wouldn't apply to. But other foods need to be, you have a piece of meat, nobody eats meat raw. I mean, maybe there's certain types of, again, but then particular types of preparation processes that are used. In general, people don't eat raw meat. So meat, Bishul Akum applies to it. You can't serve somebody a piece of meat. You can't eat a piece of meat that a non-Jew cooked. Okay? So that's Bishul Akum. What about a minor? Can a minor eat this piece of meat? A minor can absolutely eat such a piece of meat. However, a minor who's of age to be educated, there's another issue over here of educating the minor. And educating the minor applies that even though he's not forbidden in eating this rabbinically prohibited food, and that there might be many reasons why he's not prohibited, and that why Chazal didn't prohibit minors from eating the foods that they prohibited, but he's not prohibited. However, that minor has the obligation, we have the obligation, and he has an obligation upon himself also to a certain extent. That goes into much more complicated back and forth and understanding various sugyos, various pieces of Gemara, but I'm convinced that he has an obligation also on himself to train himself for the Torah mitzvot that one day he's going to be obligated in. Certainly his parents have that obligation. Therefore, the parents cannot serve their child a rabbinic prohibition product when they are of age to understand. However, a baby who is not of the age to understand, right, even very intelligent and very smart babies won't understand that this week is Pesach, and therefore we are not giving it kitnios. There's absolutely no problem for them to eat kitnios. All the more so was that even if somehow somebody's going to come up with some sort of, you know, one time I had a friend who had, that his wife gave birth to quadruplets. And so, you know, when he came to Kolel, everybody wished him, you know, Mazdo, 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 right? And there was the one guy there who asked him, you know, everybody said, you know, he said, it's, you know, it was three girls and a boy. So somebody said, oh, are you making a pidyon on Ben? So he said, well, I'll tell you like this. My wife is a bas levi. Her father's a levi. The boy, it was a cesarean. What we call in halacha, yotzei dofen. Was a cesarean. So it's also a reason why you don't make a pinyan ben. And the boy wasn't born first. Right, so sometimes you have many reasons for the same thing. Which reason comes first, I don't necessarily know. I mean, here I think by the Pidyon HaBen story, if it wasn't born first, it wasn't born first, so none of the other questions apply. But over here, when it comes to the kitnios, there's another thing. Any chola, anybody who would need the sustenance of the kitnios, would be permitted to have kitnios. The most frequent question that we're probably getting on our hotlines currently, right, in my office over here, So Rabbi Freeman answers the hotline, and he'll tell you, and you know, without my answering the hotline, I can tell you how many messages, emails, phone calls I get about Enshor, about adult, what they call here in Israel the Gil HaShlishi formulas, right? Not only Gil HaShlishi, there's also people who take it after surgeries, etc., but that are taking, you know, these shakes that they mix, and it has all sorts of things similar to baby formula in terms of that it's packed with all sorts of nutrients and different things a person needs from a nutritional vantage point. And they're almost all kitnios, right? So we get many, many questions about them. And the truth is, of course, if that's what somebody's taking because they need it for their diet, it's 100% mutter. It's permissible for them to have it. So that's another reason. But over here by a katan, we're not even getting into a hetter. If it's something that somebody's just doing because they think it's a little bit better for their child to have, you know, a cornmeal cereal or rice cereal or whatnot, right? It still would be fine for them to have. Even mothers who mostly lactate, but partially, you know, they do give some formula bottles. It's 100% permissible for them to give formula, and every single last baby formula is kitnios. They all say it on it. Some of the ashkachos recommend, and this is for a different reason, not to wash the utensils that are used for the kitnios in the sink where you wash all the rest of your dishes. Definitely not at the same time. That's meaning same way we wash milchiks and fleishiks in the sink. So if you have only one sink, right, so you put in an insert and this and that, but you certainly wouldn't put the milchik and fleishik dishes, right, the meaty and dairy dishes, into the sink together. So likewise, you certainly should not put it in together. And the reason for that is as follows. We took that starting point, which really what I wanted to bring from that starting point was as follows. Especially when it comes to Pesach, there's lots of chumras, there's lots of minhagim, packed with minhagim, more than probably any other time of year, and it's minhagim that people keep to so steadfast, much more so than in any other area. I mean, you know, you walk around, you meet people from that hail from, you know, at least their families hail from different countries in Europe where they might have had different minhagim, and by now, you know, you see you all daven in the same shul, you all send your kids to the same school, and more or less you're already doing the same things, right? I'll tell you a secret, maybe I shouldn't admit to it in public, but I had a haircut before I was three. And I grew up in a very frum house, okay? But chas v'shalom, and I was now not, you know, to cut your boy's hair before he's three. So it's a minhag that's kind of seeped into, you know, pretty much all of Klal Yisrael. Truth is, I probably wouldn't have done, but I didn't see a reason why my kids should have to suffer and be different than everybody else in their class. So we left all four of my boys, Kanai and Harkin, with long hair until they were three. But that's the lay of the land. That's what goes around. You know, a lot of people, the Minhagim, but when it comes to Pesach, people hold so strongly to those Minhagim. There are people, you know, I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, Sharon, Massachusetts. We had next door neighbors. He was a guy, she was the president of one of the Reform synagogues in Sharon. And, you know, but when it came to Pesach, they had all their Minhagim, the Kol HaPachos, right? That all her family Minhagim were still being kept, right, in their house when it came to Pesach. People have a hard time letting go from Pesach Minhagim. So Shabbos, out the window. Marrying a guy, out the window. Not everything was you know, out the window. But when it came to Pesach, that was Kodesh Kedoshim. But at the same time, we have to know what is halacha, what is the Raisa, the more biblical halachos, the Derabbanan, the rabbinical halachos, what is Chumrah, what is a kula, what is a minhag, etc. To understand these things so that we have the right approach to Pesach and we put the focus on the right things. So, back to the kitnios issue, since we had started with that. So the issue is like this. Once a minhag becomes very strong, very, very strong rooted in Klal Yisrael. There's a concept, probably many people are familiar with it, Minhag Yisrael Tairahi, Minhag Yisrael Halachahi, that Minhag Yisrael has the strength of something which is a Torah prohibition or a Torah requirement. It's Halacha that we have to follow, we adhere to it the same way we adhere to all other areas of Halacha. So now, you know, does that mean that it has the same magnitude as leaving your kid's hair long till he's 3 years old has the same magnitude as fasting on Yom Kippur? Because Torah, does that mean no? So obviously not. That's number one. And number two is that does that mean every single last minhag, things that we do that are more minor? Because we try to do it. Do I have to go ask the rabbi a shayla? Because usually I give tzedakah before I light candles Friday night, and this week I forgot to give tzedakah, or I couldn't find the 10 shekel coin I usually put into the tzedakah box or whatever it is before luck is near. So do I have to go ask a shayla to a rabbi now because I didn't do it? Right? Where does it stand when it comes to halacha lemaisa, to actually doing things and not doing things, and the shaylos, the halachic questions involved in that? So somehow, when it comes to a d'oraisa and a d'rabbanan, a biblical prohibition vis-a-vis a rabbinic prohibition, we all understand that rabbinic prohibitions are more minor, not to diminish in their magnitude at all, but that they're more minor in many senses than a biblical prohibition. That certainly carries on a step further when we talk about minhagim. Meaning, sometimes people will ask a question, they are not sure when they finished their meaty meal, right? Shabbos afternoon, obviously they don't remember, did they finish eating meat? They know they benched at 3:35, but did they finish eating meat at 2:45 or at 2:57 or at 3:01, they're not sure, right? They start making a whole fancy calculation. Well, we served it till the cake, and we brought the cake out, and we had to wait because we didn't bring plates. So I sent one of the kids to the kitchen to get a plate, and then we realized we didn't have a knife, right? So it took, so dessert took long, and they start coming up with this whole calculation as to what time it must have been or whatever it is. And they said, but I'm really not sure. So can I have my cup of coffee? Can I not have my cup of coffee? And I have, so sometimes you say, okay, big deal, just a cup of coffee you're waiting for. So wait an extra 5 minutes, right? If that's the whole question here, right? But sometimes the question is a little more complicated. I'm leaving to the airport now and I need my coffee before the flight. And I'm not going to have where to stop to get a coffee between now and the flight and whatever it is if I don't have a coffee now. And if I don't leave now, right, especially nowadays, what's going on in the airports, I'm not going to get my coffee, and I'm going to have a splitting headache the whole flight, right? So Again, you're talking about something which is really ultimately, whether you wait 5 hours, 5 plus hours, 6 hours, 3 hours, waiting some amount of time is a halacha. The exact number of hours that we wait is a minhag. So when we have a question, and it's a question of a few minutes this way or that way, yeah, when it's a question and it doesn't really make that much of a difference, just waiting a few minutes for your cup of coffee, right? So anybody who's a dietitian would tell you anyway, wait a few minutes. Mindful eating, put it aside, think about it for a few seconds, wait your extra 5 minutes, that's great self-control, that's all good. But when it comes to not being able to have your coffee and you really needed that coffee and you can't drink your coffee without milk or whatever it is, so it's fine. Drink the coffee now. It's just a question of a few minutes, and it was something which is a minute. We should be relatively lean. We shouldn't turn those into the things that this is what we're so makbid on. But when it comes to to some sort of question in Shmiras Shabbos that has a Doraisa aspect to it, that has a biblical side to it, and we're not really sure, and we say, okay, but we heard there are some opinions that are lenient or whatever it is, those are the areas to be machmir, to be more particular about. And when it comes to your minhag, okay, so you cut your boy's hair a few days early because it worked out better, right? Nobody, don't tell anybody. It's fine. Okay. So with that being said, let's talk a little bit more about some of the common practices in Pesach that sometimes get out of hand. Rav Ruderman was a Reshiva Neir Yisrael. I don't think he was necessarily known for being, particularly stringent, but he was definitely very scrupulous when it came to adherence of Torah and mitzvos. So, he said that in his town that he came from, they would whitewash, they would paint the houses before Pesach, it wasn't like that they painted the houses because, it's a good time of year to paint the house, right? It's after the winter, maybe the various leaks were fixed, or maybe not if it was in the OU. And so it's a good time of year to paint. No, but they painted it because they were worried in their houses, it was small houses, that there was chametz that got stuck and whatever it was. And the truth is, we don't think about this. I'm not giving anybody ideas, really, really not. But in the industrial kitchens that we kasher, sometimes we require them to either remove their ceiling panels and clean them, or sometimes to paint them before, if they're painted panels, so we'll let them repaint it. And the reason for that is that what happens is that when you have tremendous industrial steam and grease, maybe I shouldn't get too much into what goes on in some places in industry. Some places are very, very, very clean. Some places have very, very, very good air circulation. Just yesterday I was talking to a new CEO of an old company. And I was telling him historically he was trying to understand, something with how different paperwork on the kashrus works. So I was explaining to him how that it has to do with the history of his own, of the plant that he's the CEO, of the company that he's the CEO of. And they used to have another plant down the block that Baruch Hashem, at some point in time, the health department closed down. I said, because I couldn't do kashrus inspections there. You couldn't breathe inside there. But, so, yesh v'yesh, you have different types of places. But what happens is things drip down. That's certainly not l'chatchila to allow a ceiling that, over the course of the year, accumulated all sorts of grease and dust and things with the circulation of the steam, etc., on the ceiling. And now, as there's lots and lots, you're not talking about, it's not like, when you're cooking even an Erev Shabbos and you have all four burners or six burners if you have one of those types of stovetops or something full. No, we're talking about where they have huge, huge boiling pots and different types of apparatuses that are creating immense amounts of steam as things going back and forth. So yeah, in those scenarios, we sometimes make them clean the ceiling. Right, I'll tell you another thing. It was a point in time where we used to do audits for the gluten-free, for one of the big gluten-free certifications. It was a great idea. The OU goes around anyway. We have mashkichim and mifakrim. They go around to all the companies. So they wanted, whatever it was, twice a year that the companies that were gluten-free should be audited by a gluten-free auditor. They gave us a crash course in what needs to be checked. They gave us a very simple, here they would call it a Mifchan Amerikai, a multiple choice type of thing that you that you fill out, that your checklist, that you when you go in, and whatever it was, and maybe there were a few fields that you had to write a little bit something. At some point, they told us that we had to stop. They said we were being too machmir for them. It was coming out that none of their companies were actually gluten-free, according to them. We said, you set the standards, we just answered the questions. So we're going to get to that in a second, and that was exactly where I wanted to go. Okay, so Rav Ruderman said that in the houses in Europe, back to Rav Ruderman, they would paint their houses, at least their kitchens, before Pesach Arnu, because they were worried about there being chametz there. So he said, and he remembers that the Rav of the town was somebody who came and wanted to tell the women, okay, you can calm down, it's not the end of the world. And apparently the women would paint the kitchen themselves. So he said, you know, you get to calm down and tell them they don't have to. And the Rav said, no, you don't want to discourage anybody from any area that they're scrupulous, and you don't want to tell them that they don't have to be scrupulous in that area. So again, not telling anybody, go home and say, okay, you know what I did the last 40 years? Maybe she should have stayed. What I did the last 40 years, I don't need to do anymore. This year Pesach is going to be super simple. I'm just doing, you know, I heard some rabbi, he spoke, and he said all I need to do is X, Y, Z, and I'll Yisrael Shalom. I'm not trying to discourage anybody from what they need to do. Trying to prioritize here. Meaning, whatever chumras you have, it can be cleaning between the tiles with a toothpick or whatever it might be, or cleaning your sockets in the kitchen out. You want to do it? Again, please take all appropriate safety precautions into account. But gesundheit, hey, nobody's telling you that you have to stop any of those things. Hashem, nobody's even suggesting that you necessarily stop any of those things. If you're doing it, l'shem shemayim, continue doing it, l'shem shemayim. That's all good. However, what we should do is to prioritize things properly. You know, when I first got married, so I was very excited to have Hanukkah here in Eretz Yisrael. And to be able to light my menorah, my Chanukiah, as they say, call it here, outside. And I went through all the different halachos of Hanukkah Neros and came out with all sorts of different Hidurim, if you will, and that's definitely one of the areas where, you know, Hidur is part of the mitzvah, right? It's called Hidur mitzvah, the way we light, that everybody lights their own menorah, that you add every night. Those are all Hidurim that the Gemara already talks about. So I found all sorts of other Hidurim, which added to the candle lighting, you know, time allotment, so to speak, the time that it took to, you know, go and set up my menorah every night, to start taking out cotton, to find 100% cotton, and to make my own wicks and to make them bigger on the bottom and thinner on the top so that they burn beautifully and wonderfully and they sit perfectly in the cup and all sorts of different, you know, things to patchka around with. And Baruch Hashem, as you know, the years went on, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed us with children, and it started to become, you know, a bigger ordeal to go down to the entrance and to start setting it up and whatever it was. And, you know, my wife wanted to make the latkes then, so that after we bench licht, we'd be able to come up and sit down and have latkes at the table and, you know, etc. So it started to create a certain amount of, you know, lachatz around lighting the menorahs. Now when I give Hanukkah shiurim, I tell everybody what it took me a little bit of time to discover. So, you know, Shalom Bayis is also a hiddur. It's also an important thing, and it fits into those categories of prioritizing. Discover they make these wonderful pre-made cups. So I started buying the pre-made cups. It cut my candle lighting ordeal, you know, down by less than half, by, you know, mamish, immense amount of time. Saved a lot of time. I was able to come back even a little bit later from yeshiva, kollel, whatever you want to call it, and learn an extra 15, 20 minutes and have an extra 15, 20 minutes and be around when my wife was making the latkes or whatever it was before we went down, and everything was solved. So sometimes the questions are prioritized. It could be exactly that also. What sometimes you ask people what they remember from Pesach growing up, was all they remember was the lachatz erev Pesach. Sometimes if it's diminishing the lachatz, you know, that pressure and the screaming and all that, might be a good thing that they should have a, you know, more pleasant memories of Pesach than all of that lachatz. But certainly if there's other things that might not get done, we have to prioritize. So back to cleaning, when we talk about things like the ceiling, the truth is you probably don't have to clean the ceiling at all. Somebody didn't, yes, eventually some gook, you know, imagine most people, everybody in this room probably lights Hanukkah, lights Shabbos candles, right? Whether they use oil, whether they use candles, whether they use candles in a cup or candles that are just a stick, or whether they use not oil but some sort of, you know, some sort of colored, I forgot what they call it, what it's called right now, right? And then those little glass things with the little wick that sticks out or whatever. But everybody lights Shabbos lights of some sort. And if you look over time, right, on the ceiling above where they light their Shabbos lights, whether it's in the middle of the table or whether it's on some shelf or some sort of buffet or whatever it is on the side, eventually they'll get these little rings, black rings or grayish rings on the ceiling. But it takes a while till those rings develop, right? Unless they're probably lighting with something they shouldn't be lighting with, okay? Or they're lighting way too close to the ceiling, and that would be a different hazard, right? It takes time for such rings to develop. So the fact that eventually, you know, a little bit, because the few times that you made something that you know, one time you threw, somebody was frying something in a pot or a pan on, you know, deep, more like deep frying with a lot of oil in a pot or pan on the burner, and then they put something in, maybe they took a spatula that got wet while it was on the counter, or they just rinsed it off and they forgot to dry it off in between, and boom, it started splashing up, and so some oil, a few drops of oil, made it all the way to the ceiling. Now, over time, whether it's over the course of a year or whether it's over the course of 10 years, so yeah, you're likely to get some buildup of a little bit of grease, right? And then you turned on one time a fan or the air conditioner or whatever it was that blew a little bit more this way or that way, the direction, and a little bit of it is in the air. That's not going to come down. And when we talk about that on Pesach, there's a halacha that before Pesach, chametz b'mashu is batal, right? If a tiny piece of chametz falls into, you're making soup, and somehow a tiny, tiny bit of chametz falls into that soup, chas v'shalom, shouldn't happen to anybody. But if it does happen, it's batal, and you move on. On Pesach, if that would happen, right, some people have a minhag that they only use bottled water on Pesach, even for cooking or things like that. And the reason, and the truth is, in Israel, the Rav Rashi, there's always a picture of Erev Pesach in the newspapers and nowadays on the internet of the Rav Rashi, the Rabbanim Rashim going to shut off the water supply of Israel before Pesach so that all the water was there before it. Why are they doing that? So that if you have a worker who's eating his sandwich on the side of the Kinneret, you know, an Arab, he's allowed to eat his chametz sandwich on the side of the Kinneret on Pesach and a few crumbs fall into it. In theory, even though it's a huge kinneret and whatever it is, but you have a little bit of chametz that falls in, and Pesach chametz isn't batal even b'mashu. Now, I'm not convinced that if a sandwich fell into the kinneret and the water supply from the kinneret wasn't cut off, that you wouldn't be able to drink the water from the kinneret on Pesach for many, many, many reasons. But firstly and foremost, I don't think when it's talking about the chametz b'mashu isn't batal, doesn't mean when it's like a trillionth of the amount of what's there. It means there's a regular musagim that we have of echad b'meo, echad b'elef, right? That one in a thousand, it's really more or less the largest term that's referred to in halacha, the most minor bit that is. When something is so insignificant that nobody would ever pay any attention to it in any form or for any reason, so of course that would be batal lagamre, even on Pesach or whatever, because otherwise, right, one of my kids was asking me, he's like, If it does, you know, about different things. If somebody has something and would fall into, say, we're not concerned with anything like that. You don't see anywhere; it's not brought anywhere in halacha that a person has to shower before Pesach. It's brought that you have to shower before Pesach, like before Shabbos, but not as a special halacha that you have to shower before or earlier on in the day, so that it shouldn't be already a b'shas iser chametz that a person showered because maybe they have something that, you know. You can have a little bit. You're snacking on crackers, and I don't know, and you bent down. And tiny crumb got stuck somewhere. It happens that crumbs get stuck in the air, and it could fall back. And something which is so minute and so remote, and whatever it is. So yeah, does it happen? Does ever a piece of cracker get stuck in somebody's hair or on their or on their sweater or whatever it is? Right? Especially if you're wearing sweaters, right? Things can get stuck in sweaters, tiny amounts, and could that fall back into something? In theory, we're not choshesh. We're not worried about things to that extent. So somebody have to clean something on the ceiling. You're not putting any food on the ceiling. You don't expect anything to come down from the ceiling. That's why you don't clean it regularly. It's not just because it's hard to reach. You don't clean it regularly because it's not that dirty. It's not, you know, that it's that much of an eyesore. And you're not concerned with the fact that it's going to fall back in. Something which you have no reason to really be concerned about, you have no reason to really clean.
Does this extend on a counter?
Okay, so a countertop is another excellent example of where we're much more stringent than we might need to be. Again, I'm not going to be advocating not the kasher and not the cover or whatever it is, your countertops. No, we do kasher our countertops in our house and the areas next to the oven. So in the areas next to the oven, I do cover with aluminum foil, not the entire thing. No, it does not look like my mother-in-law's kitchen that you walk into and it's all covered with aluminum foil from head to toe, right? It does not look like that, and it doesn't look like my mother's kitchen even. Maybe it looks like my mother's new kitchen, that I can't say. I don't know if I was ever in her newest kitchen for Pesach. Maybe it does look like that. Now she has a kosher countertop also. Let's discuss countertops for a second. In halacha, what it says about a countertop is that you have to clean it well. Zehu, you open up a Shulchan Aruch, Rama, nobody argues on it. Nobody says anything about covering it with two coverings, three coverings, seven coverings. And I've heard everything, and I've seen it brought in more modern Sfarim. People write even things like five tablecloths on the table, and they have a whole halachic cheshbon, a thing of why to put five. I'm not going to get into that because I don't agree with it. So, but they have, you know, they have their cheshbonos, why they say however many layers to put on it. In Shulchan Aruch, it says to clean it well. Why? First of all, it's not generally used hot. Second of all, you don't generally put food directly on it. Third of all, if it's clean and the food that you're putting on it now on Pesach isn't hot, okay? So even if I would take a matzah, I don't usually put food on the counter. Maybe sometimes I do. And even when I sometimes do, it's all, you know, could I have one time drop something hot on the counter or whatever it is? Maybe, but I don't generally put hot food on the counter. So it's usually used cold. So even if I put a piece of bread down there once when I was in the middle making a sandwich or whatever it was, right? And now I put down a piece of matzah on it, so long as it was clean, what's the problem? It's totally clean. It's not getting, because a month ago I put down a piece of bread on the counter when I was making a sandwich, or even Erev Pesach, early in the morning, obviously, but that probably wouldn't happen in most people's houses anyway. So I'd say half a week before Pesach, they put a piece of bread down on the counter. Right? If they're still keeping Shabbos Hagol, they still didn't really kosher their kitchen yet, maybe partially, you know, whatever it is. I'm not getting into the partial ideas, that's a different subject. But they put down a piece of challah on the counter on Shabbos, and now it's already Wednesday, Thursday, right? And they put down a piece of matzah on the counter, if it was cleaned well in between. So what's going to happen? It's not getting it's getting crumbs, whatever it is. Even Corona, nobody was worried that because they put something down, if they sprayed enough Ajax on it, that it was going to be getting any Corona a week later, you know, because whatever. That wasn't what people were concerned with.
What about the things on the sinks, the taps?
I just want to finish with the countertops. So like this, now why should a person maybe cover the countertops or kosher their countertops? So the truth is like this. I said most people don't. However, I don't know that it's true. Many people do put down a hot pot on the counter, right? They take it off the stove and they put it onto the counter. And if they put it on the counter, if they put the hot pot on the counter and a little bit of the soup, it boiled over a tiny bit and there was a little bit of liquid that came out of the pot and then they put it down on the counter, right? So now the counter got, and the pot is still boiling hot when they put it down. The soup that falls down presumably is still going to be hot. Now again, I can start going into all the depth of the pieces of Gemara that talk about something cold touching something hot, and do we say that it becomes hot enough from the thing which is hot? But it could be that there's going to be at least some scenarios where, yes, it did get hot enough. And could that happen again on Pesach? So during the year, that area I put down something hot on. And now on Pesach, a similar story happened. The pot started boiling over. I quickly rushed over to the pot, took it off the stove, and put it on the counter right next to it. And I forgot that a week ago I put some sort of sauce that I was making that also overflowed from the pot. I was making a pasta sauce, and it called for a little bit of, you know, flour or something like that to thicken it. And I put it on the side, and now there was boiling hot chametz on the counter. And now I put my boiling hot chicken soup or whatever it was that I'm going to be using for Leil Seder on the same spot on the counter. And it could be somewhat problematic, especially if it happened before Pesach, it'd probably be fine. But if it happened on Pesach, it may be problematic. And if we can avoid such scenarios in the first place, so it's a good idea to avoid those scenarios in the first place. That's why I said in our house, we kasher the counters, because there might be questions about if the kashering really works on the counter or not, so, and if it was done fully properly or not. So the areas where we're apt to putting down hot pots, both during the year and on Pesach, we make a little pad, like a, you know, big enough that you should be able to put down whatever pots or pans you want to straight off the burner conveniently onto it. And with that, I think, you know, then I think it's sufficient, because yeah, and Pesach I'm extra particular not to put down a hot pot or pan anywhere else on the counter where it's not covered.
The material of the countertop makes a difference.
If it's formica, it's not kosherable. So then I would definitely cover anywhere where you're going to put down something hot, where you might put down something hot. And it's not a bad idea to cover it in its entirety, again, because maybe something's wet and is going to sit on it for a day. Again, most of us, we don't do that, but Pesach, where you're not using your dishwashers, most people don't have Pesach dishwashers, and, you know, don't kosher their dishwashers, etc. So they use they use a sink, even though during the year they don't, and they have many more dishes after the Lila Seder, and they had all their children and grandchildren and some guests and some neighbors and whatever it is, right? Kol Dichvin, they invited everybody into Lila Seder, and they really had a Kol Dichvin. They had a whole bunch of hungry people who came to their Lila Seder, and they had a lot of dishes to wash up afterwards, and it took more time. They were tired. They stayed up so late Seder night, and it took a little bit of time. They didn't have a kayach to dry the dishes afterwards, and they left it sitting in a little bit of a puddle on the counter, whatever it is. Don't tell any of the neighbors that that's what happened after a little Seder in our house. And it stayed there, and when something sits in water for 24 hours, so that could be considered also kavosh, that it's like pickled, so to speak. No, not that it got the pickly smell, but that it's pickled from a halachic vantage point, which is also has obeyed rabbinically, but it's considered to be cooked, and because of that, that would be a problem. So I don't think a minhag that doesn't apply can become a minhag. Meaning, nobody leaves their girl's hair till age 3 to cover because their father only had boys, and their father only had boys, so they're going to leave their girl's hair till 3. I mean, maybe they want to leave their girl's hair to 3 because they want it to grow long anyway, right? That's not such a chiddush to leave your girl's hair long. It's more of a chiddush to leave your boy's hair long. But, I mean, not nowadays, sorry. but anyway.
Better be careful.
Anyway, right. No. So I'm talking about in our community is obviously. Okay. Anyway. Yeah, anyway.
No, but for 43 years.
So I don't think, and even if you did, even if you continued doing so, I don't think it became, again, if you're asking me, I'm. And I'm very comfortable saying so. I do not think it becomes a minig tos. And there are certain types of minhagim. If somebody was noeg davar tov, somebody took on a good thing to do. They were makabel that every Shabbos they're going to go visit somebody who's sick or somebody who's old, whatever it is. You know, they want to go visit somebody who's bedridden every single Shabbos. So it's a wonderful minhag, and they said it. They said this is my new Kabbalah, right? It was their birthday. It was Yom Kippur. It was whatever, Rosh Hashanah, whatever it was. One of these times of years that people like to make Kabbalos, and they said I'm making a Kabbalah that I'm going to visit a sick person or somebody older, bedridden, something like that every Shabbos, and it works. 5 years, 6 years, they never miss a Shabbos. 1 week, they end up being that they go to visit their son, their daughter, their mother, their sister, whatever it is, in some town somewhere, and they ask around. There's no old age home. There's nobody particularly old here. It's a new development. It's all young families. No, Baruch Hashem, nobody's sick, right? So they're not going to go and give somebody a punch in the face and have somebody who's bedridden that they can go visit, and they can't visit. So the halacha is that they have to make hataras in the darm. So they go and they make hataras in the darm. Now, or if they decide they want to stop, it's starting to become cumbersome to them. They're not as young as they used to be. Maybe they need people coming to visit them now already. Whatever it is, it's not, or they have a very busy schedule. They were makabel that, you know, if it's somebody young, maybe before they had a dozen children. Now, Kenai Nahara, they're already holding by a dozen children, and they can't make it out anymore on Shabbos. So they're busy with another mitzvah. They're raising HaKadosh Baruch Hu's children. It's beautiful and wonderful. But what do they do about that kabbalah? They were makabel themselves. So yeah, then they have to go and do Hataras Adarim. They can either do it themselves or send a shaliach. in front of a Beis Din Hedyot, they find three men and they say, listen, I was one of, at least one of the people in the Beis Din needs to know what the neder was, what the Kabbalah was, so to speak, because something that you did right, that you did good, becomes like a neder. It's as if you promised that you're going to do it. So you did it already, maybe you even promised that you're going to do it. At that point in time, you want to stop doing it, so you have to go and do a Taras Adarim. And you have to, and there has to be a reason why you're doing it. As you said, until now I was able to do it because it was easy. Now it's hard. Or until now I was able to do it because I always found somebody that was sick or old or whatever it is that I could go visit. And now I can't find anybody anymore. Right? And then they say, okay, so that's a Pesach. You never thought you'd be in such a situation, so we can be Matan Edu. You never realized that you'd get to a situation that you'd be so busy with your own household or whatever it is. But we'll be Matan Edu for you. And they say, Motolach, Motolach, Motolach. And finished. You don't have to do the minig anymore. However, if somebody did something totally by mistake, they thought that this was the right thing to do. They thought that when they say Kriya Shema, they have to put their left hand to hold the sitter open and their right hand on their eyes. I don't know. And then somebody told them you don't need to hold the sitter open with your left hand, right? You don't have to do anything. And I said, really? And I said, yeah, really. He said, I don't know, somebody told me that that's what you do. So maybe the person who told him that, they meant it just as common sense, right? You have a sitter that's going to close on its own. You want to keep it open while you put your cover your eye. Usually you're right-handed, so usually you hold your sitter with your right hand, so hold it with your left hand and cover your eyes with your right hand. But they didn't realize that. And now they have, you know, a sitter that they've used for so many years, it stays open on its own, so they don't have to do that anymore. They don't have to be mater neder. Because they made a mistake thinking that was halacha. It's not halacha. So too over here, somebody says that they were that they thought they had to cover a countertop that was fully kasherable because their mother covered it and because their mother's mother covered it. Again, if somebody wants to, like we started off, am I going to say that you shouldn't do anything? You say, okay, I don't know if I kashered it properly, if I cleaned it well enough before I kashered. Something like that. If somebody wants to cover it, because they're concerned of that. So adrabah, and if that was the reason why they continued, now they're a little bit less nervous. Then, you know what? I think I am cleaning it well enough. I used to be nervous or whatever it is. That might be a grayer area where maybe it would require hataras nadarim. A person would have to go and tell a rabbi, listen, it's too hard for me to cover it. I used to be able to have the kayach to do it. And I did it because I was nervous, and I know it was maybe, you know, excessive that I was nervous, you know, I guess I'm getting a little bit less OCD as I'm getting older or whatever it is, something like that. And, you know, I'm less nervous. I'm comfortable that I clean it well, right? So that then they would maybe need hataras nadarim because they were doing it out of halachic concern. If it was a mistake that they were doing it, they wouldn't have to be matir neder. If they were doing it out of halachic concern, then yes, they probably need to be matir neder. Again, unless that halachic concern was a mistake. So you're doing it because a rabbi told you, again, I don't know who the rabbi was, and I don't want to say, you know, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about or whatever it is. But again, I don't understand that, because the fact that, like I said, it would be like leaving your girl's hair till age 3 to cut. Because if it doesn't apply, it doesn't apply. Your mother covered a counter that wasn't kasherable, and your grandmother covered a counter that wasn't kasherable. Now that you have a counter which is kasherable, you wouldn't have, you don't have to cover it. Again, I do recommend covering the areas next to the stovetop, even on a counter like that, because I don't think that it's so easy to be sure that you kasher a counter 100% properly. Like, there could be areas that you, because it means, especially with the granite or the marble, that it can have little imperfections, and you have to clean out those areas. And whatever it is, and it's a large area, and you know, and you're doing it late at night, and maybe you didn't notice, and whatever it is. And the seams and all those types of areas, it might be complicated doing it. And to pour the hot water over such a large area from a kli rishon, meaning the utensil that it was boiled in, the pot or pan or whatever it is that it was boiled in, the best etza, again, I'm not taking any responsibility for safety, the best etza how to kasher a countertop or anything that you need to pour hot water over, that you're doing irui, kli rishon, that you're pouring hot water out of a kli rishon, is to take like the Shabbos urn, not the little kumkum, because it's not going to get you very far unless you have a very small countertop or sink that you're kashering. And yes, you can do it in halves, but the easiest thing is you take your big Shabbos urn, whatever you want to call it, Mecham Shabbat, all the different terms that are used for it, Samovar, all the right, whatever terms people use for it. You take that, you boil the water in it, you don't even have to tip it over. I think it's actually safer. You open the little spigot, that spout at the bottom, and you kind of just, and you take the handles at the top and you roll it back very slowly from side to side over the countertop. I do recommend wearing I'm wearing like rain boots, or maybe rain boots might not be the best advice, because then if it gets through it, it would be hard to get off. I actually use like the Crocs. Crocs with the out holes are the best, right? And stay as far away as you can from it. The best is to find somebody else to kasher for you. But I always tell my wife, the one job you make sure to give whatever cleaning help you get is that they use the St. Moritz in the oven, not you, right? So that's always the best advice, is to find somebody else to do it. But that's I think is the easiest way to do a Iri Kli Rishon on a countertop or most other flat surfaces. For sinks, the little kumkum can be very convenient. If you have two of them, then it's excellently convenient, because then you can do it really close to one another. You don't have to wait for it to boil again. You know, take another few minutes till you fill it up with water and boils out, and then you don't remember exactly until what part of the sink you did it, so you end up doing it four or five times to make sure you cover the whole sink. It makes it a little bit more simple and convenient. I think we probably went well over time now. So I think it's probably more problematic than anything else. I'm explaining to you like this. It's not...
I didn't hear the question.
The issue, there are a lot of people who put like a sock, like shmata, or just a piece of cloth over the tap. Uh-huh. Okay, and the reason why they do that, it's not so upgefrecht, it's not so... nonsensical to do something like that in theory, right? Because you're concerned, okay, during the year you wash dishes and sometimes you stick it in, you have big pots and you stick it into the pot, especially, right, you have everybody with the fancy faucets that come out with the whole with that whole little, you know, snake that they pull out, the accordion like snake, and they stick it into their pots and they wash it out and whatever it is, and it gets cooked from the pots, you know, water, there's things that get stuck to it again, and there's build up and that type of thing, and they're concerned with that on Pesach. Again, when we talked about bittul at the beginning, in theory, I think that even on Pesach, the bittul from such a thing exists. Because that's so minute that we never are concerned about what the amount of water that's coming out toch kadeh while you're doing it. You know, it's washing your pot. It's not making it dirty. You never think like, oh my goodness, and if somebody had some sort of extreme allergy, you wouldn't be concerned with that. Maybe because 2 weeks ago I washed out something with the, you know, I washed out the, after I baked challah, I washed out the mixer. So that maybe a little bit of the dough is going to get back in, and that celiac that I have over for Shabbos now is going to get, you know, some sort of emergency reaction. You're not really concerned with that because it's so, so minute. So that's when it comes to the bittul. I think that the bittul would apply over here, because that's not what they're talking about. But it's not bottle but aleph. This is way more than aleph. That's number one. It's whatever was got stuck to it. Again, if you had a sink that what you wash out all the time is dough, and you know that there's lots of pieces of dough that get stuck to the spout, probably you should go to the hardware store and buy a new spout, okay, for Pesach. And if it's an expensive spout, then you have to take off, and it's a whole assembly, you can't just change one piece of it or whatever it is. So buy a separate spout that you can take off and put on for Yom Tov. Again, that would be only an extreme scenario where what they're washing, that they have, it's like a bakery, all they do is they bake in the sink, and all they're doing is washing dough, and there's mamish pieces of dough that are coming off it, and they see that, okay? That would be like a very extreme scenario. Without that, I don't think it's a problem. When it comes to putting a sock or something like that on top, it makes it worse. Because what happens is, until now, whatever was stuck to the faucet, and I cleaned it off. I do recommend cleaning. You should clean every area, right, before Pesach. But now I cleaned it off. I did the best. I scrubbed it with a piece of, with scotch or whatever they call it here, right, with steel wool. I washed it out well, and I maybe even took a little toothpick and went around the aerator a few times and that type of stuff. I washed it well, cold water, hot water, soap, and etc. Whatever stuck to it is stuck to it, and it's part of it. And if it somehow, when it's on for a while with some very hot water coming out, a little bit comes out, again, I told you I think that the bittul would apply to that. But it becomes, so to speak, part of it. If it separates, and it separates out of the water because it got caught on the sock, and now it takes longer for it to come out, and it comes out only the next time or something like that, that's where I have a bigger problem. Then that piece of chametz might not be batel. So I think that putting the sock on is counterproductive. Okay, that's, but and as somebody who does want to be machmir, and most years I think I do manage to change, you know, the at least the aerator piece and whatever it is on the faucet, I think that's a great thing to do if a person can. So adarabo, change it and whatever it is. To be machmer when it's easy, that's the best thing. I told my wife this year, I said, my son's in America now. So before he comes back before Pesach, please remember to order new knobs for the stove. Right? because, and again, what happened was one year I cleaned them all. I cleaned them, you know, we soaked them in St. Moritz overnight. And it's they some little pieces inside got a little bit weakened, you know, over the years. Knight and Har, my oven is, we bought it when we got married. It was secondhand. So we got married 18 and a half years ago. So it's now, I guess, like a 20 and a half year old oven, which my wife is not giving up. It's a Maytag oven. She's not giving up her gas Maytag oven, self-clean or whatever it is, with the stovetop on top. So the handles got a little bit, you know, I guess there was enough grease that was holding it together by then already, that when you degreased it, it started to fall apart a little bit. So I said, I'm not doing that again this year. Let's order a separate set of handles for a Pesach. What you can replace and what you can be firm about and what you can clean, it's always best to do what you can. But to try to do it in a convenient way that makes sense. And again, then to prioritize, you know, is this a real problem? Is it not a real problem? Is there another way around it if it is somewhat of a problem? And that's the best approach when it comes to cleaning for Pesach. I think this ended up being a much more original shiur than previous year's shiur before Pesach. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for starting with such an excellent question. And Be'ezus Hashem, we shall be zeicha to Chag Kosher v'Sameach, and halavai, shenizke lechol min hazvachim min hapsachim.
It's good that you're getting the Maytag knot.